On this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech, red lights are bad at math, IBM is growing its cloud, and Matt Cawthorn of ExtraHop is here to talk about digital sandpaper for your data friction. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 238, recorded May 5th, 2017, ExtraHop Network Analytics.
This Week in Enterprise Tech is literally brought to you by Sonic, to its 10-gig fiber internet service provider. Join Sonic's internet revolution as they bring fast, affordable internet, phone, and TV to homes and businesses all over California. Visit sonic.com/twit to sign up for service and receive your first month free. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoCD, an on-premise, open-source, continuous delivery server by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you complete control and visibility into your deployments across multiple teams. And since GoCD is open source, you can download and use it for free. To discover the power of their pipelines, visit gocd.io/twit.
Welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech, the internet's best weekly show on enterprise technology. That's according to 9 out of 10 open source routers. I'm your host, Kurt Franklin, and no, your eyes and ears aren't deceiving you. I am your host this week. Both Padre and Lou are out doing interesting things that they can't tell us about, but fortunately, I'm here with my buddy Brian Chi, who can tell us about what he's doing. Brian, what's going on out there in paradise?
Me and Grommet are just kind of hanging out and sweating. It's pretty hot and dealing with a shipment of computer equipment that came from Maui to Honolulu. And all they did was unrack the gear, stick it in a big box, and ship it with no bubble wrap. So it's going to be a real interesting time with the insurance adjusters.
Oh, boy. And nothing says good time party like the prospect of talking to insurance adjusters. Well, let's see if we can't make things a little happier by getting straight into the blips. IBM is seeding its cloud with Verizon. Verizon is selling its cloud and managed hosting service to IBM. The deal, expected to close later this year, brings 700 customers to IBM Cloud and expands the company's global footprint. For Verizon's part, the agreement allows its enterprise services business to focus on providing connectivity for enterprises to cloud applications. Now, enterprise cloud is a priority for IBM Corp. Revenues from IBM's cloud services and related activities, which IBM calls strategic imperatives, totaled $7.2 billion in the quarter ending March 1st, which was up 12% year over year. Cloud revenue was $3.5 billion, up 33%. While Verizon's enterprise cloud business withers, the telco has been transforming into a media company, buying AOL for $4.4 billion in 2015 and planning to close its $4.5 billion acquisition of Yahoo in several months. Verizon sold its data centers to Equinix late last year. The company is looking to content and applications that run on top of its network, as well as 5G wireless technologies, for future growth.
Well, it seems red light cameras may be using some faulty math. Mats Jarlström hails from Sweden and may have become a hero to drivers everywhere. It seems when his wife got a ticket in Beaverton, Oregon from a red light camera, he didn't take this laying down and worked the math. He figured out that the traffic lights were using a set of faulty math formulas to determine if vehicles being ticketed actually had enough time to make it through the intersection or not. The timing on how long a yellow light is on is based upon a whole lot of variables, and Mats managed to prove the formula for traffic light timing just wasn't giving enough time for a driver to make it through the intersection before the red light is triggered. This was even questioned by one of the original creators of the formula, and he states, This formula, which we derive, cannot be applied to turning lanes or to any situation where the driver must decelerate within the critical distance, said Alexei Maradudin. The only surviving physicist of the three that created it wrote in a 2015 letter to the Institute for Transportation Engineers. So expect this precedence to be used by a lot of folks trying to get off on red light tickets.
The cloud is driving the Infosys plan to bring 10,000 jobs to the U.S. In the face of criticism from President Donald Trump that Infosys and other outsourcing firms are taking jobs from Americans, Infosys says that cloud and related technologies are driving a company plan to bring 10,000 tech jobs to the U.S. The Indian consulting and services company says it plans to hire 10,000 American workers over the next 2 years, opening four new technology and innovation hubs in the country, focusing on cutting-edge technology areas, including artificial intelligence, machine learning, user experience, emerging digital technologies, cloud, and big data. Infosys will hire experienced technology professionals and recent graduates from major universities and local and community colleges, as well as providing training programs in key competencies such as user experience, cloud, artificial intelligence, big data, and core technologies and computer science skills, the company said.
Get this. A pirate kiosk in the middle of an Ethiopian mall lets you download movies to your user USB stick for pennies. So we can add a kiosk to download pirated movies, TV shows, and music onto a USB stick to the Ethiopian prince inheritance jokes. So for as little as 5 Ethiopian birr, about 22 cents US, you can download a movie. It seems there are employees of Escape Computing, the company behind the kiosk, that torrent all day to populate these kiosks to provide customers with a selection of current movies, TV shows, and music. Hey, if you're interested, there are immediate openings in various Ethiopian cities for sales associates in this growing market.
Dell EMC is bringing its hybrid cloud to the Azure stack. Dell EMC is bringing its hybrid cloud infrastructure to Microsoft's new Azure stack as the two companies look to make a play for the enterprise data center and companies that are using a combination of private and public clouds. Though public cloud platforms are garnering most of the attention, Dell is betting on a market where many enterprises move some applications to the cloud and keep other workloads on premises, but use cloud technologies within those data centers. Dell has been developing hybrid cloud platforms for the last 3 years, and the Dell EMC Cloud for Azure Stack is the next step in that process. Microsoft's Azure Stack looks to bring many of the same features found in the Azure public cloud platform to the private data center, focusing on enterprises that are already heavily invested in Microsoft's ecosystems and using applications built on the company's development platforms. In addition to the company's servers, networking gear, and other hyperconverged infrastructure, the Dell EMC Cloud for Azure offers backup, app development tools, data protection, and encryption, which can work in private as well as public clouds. The Dell EMC hybrid platform can start at 4 nodes to support up to 100 Azure virtual machines and can scale up to 12 nodes supporting 600 virtual machines. Well, that's it for the blips. It's on to the bites, but before we go there, let's call in Padre to tell us about one of Twyatt's fine advertisers.
Thanks, guys. Let's take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, this episode is literally brought to you by Sonic, Twit's 10 gig fiber internet service provider. Now, Sonic is dedicated to providing a better internet experience. I know there's a lot of companies out there that say that, but Sonic's actually committed to it. And that's what they've been showing people over the last couple of years. They're truly dedicated to giving you a better experience than what you can get from one of the other providers. And they want to bring internet freedom to all with their unlimited and uncapped internet. Sonic delivers residential and business fiber to the premise networks with gigabit connectivity in San Francisco, the North Bay, and the East Bay. Their internet service plans include 15 email accounts and 1 gigabyte of storage, personal web hosting with a new domain, and a fax service. They even include a home phone connection with unlimited local and long-distance calling. And get this, all of that, for only $40 per month. You're going to get download speeds of up to a gig. Okay, on a personal note, I have always been impressed by Sonic's long-standing commitment to customer support privacy. Their record shames other ISPs because they don't treat your privacy as an option. It's not an add-on. It's not a tactic to get you to buy their service. It's something that they believe in. They believe in privacy. They believe in support. They believe in all those things, and it's baked into their DNA. Now, by standing up for privacy, friendly and local customer support, uncapped bandwidth, and affordable pricing for all their products, Sonic's customer advocacy is paving the way for a better state of the internet access in America. Folks, you can vote by supporting Sonic. You can vote by getting better service. You can vote for all this privacy, for all this wonderful consumer protection by supporting Sonic. We do here at Twit. We think you should too. Join the internet revolution. Visit sonic.com/twit and receive your first month of Sonic internet and phone service for free. Plus, bundle with Dish and save $120 off your Sonic bill. Visit sonic.com/twit. That's sonic.com/twit. And we thank Sonic for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Well, thank you, Padre. We appreciate that good word. And believe it or not, that's not the last we'll see of Padre on this episode where he isn't here. Well, while we all ponder that particular mystery, let's get on to the Enterprise Bites. And the first one has some scary stuff wrapped in it. Intel has released a patch for the remote code execution in CPU active management technology. Remote management features that have been shipped with Intel processors for almost a decade contain a critical flaw that gives attackers full control over the computers that runs on vulnerable networks. That's according to an advisory published Monday afternoon by Intel. Now, Intel has released a patch for the vulnerability, which resides in the chipmaker's active management technology, Intel Small Business Technology, and Intel Standard Manageability. Business customers who buy computers running vPro processors use those services to remotely administer large fleets of computers. The bug, and this is important, doesn't affect chips running on consumer PCs. The chipmaker has rated the vulnerability critical and is recommending vulnerable customers install a firmware patch. Now, security experts spent much of Monday assessing the real-world threat posed by the bug. A post published earlier in the day claimed, quote, every Intel platform from Nehalem to Kaby Lake had a remotely exploitable security hole, end quote, that had gone unfixed for years. Researchers who parsed Intel's advisory, however, said the flaw could likely be exploited over the internet only when Intel's AMT service was enabled and provisioned inside a network. Now, other researchers said the bar for unsupervised network attackers to succeed was probably even higher because Windows-based software was known as local manageability service would have to be running. So you have to have a number of things going for this to come into play. So the reality is that many organizations have not exposed the service processor like technology to publicly reachable networks, but rather tend to deploy these on isolated management-only networks. Now, Brian, I want to turn to you because I know you've been involved in deploying a lot of network components that are going to have these servers inside. How big a deal do you think this particular flaw is going to be out in the real world?
Okay, so let me stress, perimeter defense, kind of dead. So in theory, you should be running at least a zone technology so you can look at different things with your IDSs and IPSs. The management system apparently can be enabled either through a second NIC, I think. This is one of the things I'm still digging for. But most likely, it's going to be enabled over the primary NIC on an enterprise workstation. So if you have access to a subnet or a segment that has this turned on and you have an infected machine, so don't click on that URL. That ad from the Ethiopian prince, you know, I'm sorry, not going to help you. Then there's some vulnerability. The issue is here is a lot of folks actually aren't using the Intel AMT system yet. It's still fair, you know, even though it's a decade old, a lot of people are using other things, you know, like from Microsoft or whatever. And, you know, it's it it's a problem, but it's not a widespread problem because it's not that popular. Sorry, Intel. Now, I need to stress, this is not to be confused. This is a workstation, enterprise workstation vulnerability only. It does not affect servers because servers instead use things like IPMI, iDRAC, or ILO on a service processor, which is a daughter board on the computer that gives you things like, oh, gee, temp in the CPU and GPUs, fan speeds, and things like that, and also gives you the ability for remote power off. Those are typically implemented on an isolated management-only network and thusly have not seen a lot of vulnerabilities. Their security is not great, but typically you're not foolish enough to implement this over a production network. So it is workstation only. It is the vPro series only. And considering like my organization, they're too cheap to buy vPros. So in theory, the University of Hawaii has very few vPro workstations on its network.
Now, given what you've been saying about the vPro workstations, it does sound like this is the kind of thing that might be worrisome to an organization that has a lot of fairly high-powered workstations. So I'm thinking about companies in the aerospace industry, certain parts of the government, maybe parts of the financial industry, say the quants, the people who are actually doing analysis. Is that the kind of application where you're likely to see the sort of platform that is vulnerable to this?
Yeah, definitely. You know, vPro has been very popular with people that do lots of number crunching, lots of simulations and things like that. Anyone that's running vPro needs to do this patch and needs to do this patch soon. The good news is the AMT platform does allow you to do remote updates. So as long as your network isn't compromised, you can push these updates out through the Intel management platform. Worth doing. Just tell your people, leave your machine on one particular evening so that your IT group can go and push these changes out. It's worth doing.
Okay, so this is one that definitely can be ameliorated. You can do mitigation on this. But let me quickly ask, since this has spread through so many different iterations of the chip, it indicates to me that this is something that was pretty deep in the firmware. How disturbing is it to you that it took Intel this long to deal with it? And frankly, looking at how it happened, it was someone outside the company that found it. Does that indicate that there could be more deeply seated problems and vulnerabilities in the firmware for these chips?
Yeah, just... You know, look at what a CPU really is. We're talking about very, very low-level programming where the line is blurred between hardware design and software design. So in Intel's defense, things like that are kind of hard to find. Their bad, though, is that they, in this day and age, especially, come on, Intel, a decade-old bug, makes me kind of wonder if maybe the bad guys found it a long time ago and we just haven't heard about it. The researchers that did find this, you know, do say they only, when they went out and searched the internet, they only found about, I think they said 7,000 of these on the net. So that's a good sign. I would imagine a lot of these types of machines are on isolated networks so that they can't be reached from the outside world. But, kind of disturbing, decade to issue a fix, security hole that has been dragged across 1, 2, 3, 4 chip platforms. Ah, oops.
Well, I know we all worry about zero-day vulnerabilities. It seems like a zero-decade vulnerability is much, much worse. Well, while we all scan around to see just how many of these workstations we have on our networks, let's move to the second bite. This one involves a Google search for law enforcement. Internet giant Google is vowing to fight a search warrant demanding that Edina, Minnesota police be able to collect information on any resident who used certain search terms as authorities try to locate a thief who swindled a resident out of $28,500. Privacy law experts say that the warrant is based on an unusually broad definition of probable cause that could set a troubling precedent. Quote, "This kind of warrant is cause for concern because it's closer to those dragnet searches that the Fourth Amendment is designed to prevent," end quote. That's William McGivern, a law professor at the University of Minnesota. Issued by Hennepin County District Judge Gary Larson in early February, the warrant pertains to anyone who searched variations of the resident's name on Google from December 1st through January 7th. A spokesperson for Google, which received the warrant, said on Friday, quote, "We will continue to object to this overreaching request for user data and, if needed, will fight it in court. We will always push back when we receive excessively broad requests for data about our users," end quote. Now, we have to note that in general, Google likes to support law enforcement. This is not a company that goes around thumbing its nose at the man. They really do cooperate in most cases, but this is a search warrant that is awfully darned broad, and not to mention it could involve information that could potentially be spread around the globe. Now, McGivern, the law professor at the University of Minnesota, said that it's unusual for a judge to sign off on a warrant that bases probable cause on so few facts. He said it's much more usual for a search warrant to be used to gather evidence for a suspect that's already identified rather than using evidence to find a suspect. If the standards for getting a broad warrant like this are not strong, you can have an awful lot of police fishing expeditions. And frankly, it's not hard to imagine what some of those fishing expeditions could be like, whether you've got people searching on terms around planned protests, around direct political action, around criminal activity, whether it be drug activity or human trafficking, or many, many more. This is really troubling because digital assistants, including Google Home and Amazon Echo, have been revealed to have digital records of audio the devices hear while powered on, rather than just search histories as the searches and commands are executed. Therefore, trolling through those could reveal all kinds of interesting data on anyone who happened to be within earshot or microphone shot of the digital assistant. Now, Brian, I want to turn to you because on the one hand, I know that you tend to be on the side of law enforcement, but do you think that something like this is overreaching in terms of what they're trying to do with a warrant?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Now, you can very easily log into your Google account and go and look up your search history. Now, that'll get you, anytime you're logged in to the browser or logged in as to the Google system and you do searches, it will actually log those searches. Now, as far as law enforcement is concerned, this is an amazingly rich way. You know, if someone starts looking how to make a bomb, they'd kind of like to know that. But I equate this with, gee, I don't know if you were a bad guy, but I want to read your personal journal or diary. Hand it over, and I don't, you know, the judge says, yeah, you can go into an entire town of, you know, several thousand and get everybody to hand over their personal journals and diaries. That's kind of what they're asking for. And even though, you know, technically I was law enforcement, this is really broad. And one of the wonderful, wonderful things about living in America is that our privacy is supposed to be protected. Now, say if this was, you know, Russia, you know, or some, you know, communist nation, the old Stasi, you know, I'm sure this would be perfect for them. But this is America. Dang it. I'd like to be able to know that if I'm an author writing, say, fiction, and I'm looking for, say, information on a Bofors canon for a science fiction novel that I'm writing, that I don't have the local police banging on my door saying I'm a terrorist. There are reasonably good explanations on why certain people do what could technically be misinterpreted as a nefarious search. So I'm pretty worried about this, and I don't want this to go too far. And Google, go, go, Google. Come on.
You know, I agree with you, because I think it's important to make the point that here in the U.S., it's not illegal to know things. You mentioned explosives. Well, you know, it's not illegal to know how to build a cannon. It's not illegal to know how to build a bomb. It's not illegal to know how various poisonous chemicals work. I can well remember when I was writing for a site called How Stuff Works, I did a lot of research on an article for how insecticide works. And trust me when I say that for most purposes, the only difference between insecticide and chemical warfare weapons are the dosages. It's basically the same chemistry at work. If someone had been trolling through all of the search data for that, they might have seen that. And if they had gotten a search warrant, well, what we've seen over and over is that things that are found in incidental searches, in other words, if I happen to have something lying around the house, well, that might be used to cite me for a crime entirely unrelated to the original search warrant. Now, Brian, I want to ask another question, because we've been talking about this in terms of searches, but do you think that the rise of the Google Home, the Amazon Alexa, and what is reputed or purported to be an upcoming Apple Siri device, does that change the equation in any way, knowing that there's something there that is always listening, if only to know when you want it to do something? Does that make this a different level of problem from your point of view?
Yeah, especially, you know, if a judge sets the precedence that they can get such a wide spread net to go and look. If you go and look at your Google history, I've got a Google Home, and just for grins and giggles, I went through my Google search history. And it is amazing at how sensitive those microphones are. This is a feature. I can scream from, you know, the next room, "Hey, Google, you know, what's my next appointment?" And 9 times out of 10, it's going to hear me. Now, it also hears a lot of background information, and I can actually go through my Google search history and press play and listen to all the things that my Google Home can hear. If a judge can have a Google search warrant that broad, it's almost like law enforcement can legally have a listening a microphone, a bug, in everyone's household and be able to go search through that. And because Google has the capability of doing text to speech to text, that means it's also searchable. A very, very slippery slope that I strongly suggest everybody to go and fight when possible. And that your local law enforcement, you know, if you know judges, if you know law enforcement people, tell them this precedence is really, really bad. And I'm sorry, but the Stasi are smiling in their grave.
Well, Brian, you know that you and I have a friend and colleague, a gentleman named Tom Henderson, who frequently writes for Network World, who can go on epic rants about what this means for privacy. And, you know, let me also say, I have heard some legal experts speaking on this topic, and they say that one of the dangers of things like the digital assistants is their potential erosion of what is known as the reasonable man defense. In other words, is something private if a reasonable person expects it not to be heard? Now, when we had none of these digital assistants, if you were within the four walls of your house, a reasonable person might well assume that no one else could hear what they were saying. If you have a digital assistant, then a reasonable person might well assume that that digital assistant is always listening. And that has legal implications. So this is yet another of those situations where we have law that is gradually, painfully, and I think what's going to ultimately be very messily catching up with the technology. Now, I doubt that this is the last we're going to hear on this topic, but we have a great guest for you today. You know, Brian was talking about analyzing all this data, and that's what our guest is going to be talking about, deep, serious analytics. We want to have plenty of time to talk with him, and we're going to do that. But before we do, we have another great quiet advertiser. We'll send it over to Padre to tell you all about them.
Thanks, guys. We'll get back to the action in just a bit. But first, let's take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Hey, developers, come a little closer. Look, I understand you get a raw deal here. You do an incredibly important service and nobody ever respects you. Nobody ever thanks you for how difficult it is to do what you do, to do deployments and nearly 24/7 availability, all while keeping the engine of your business running. Well, we've got a tool that might help you get the recognition and the kudos that you deserve, and it's called GoCD. GoCD understands the difficulties of deployment in a 24/7 environment, and one that demands the five nines of uptime, even as real-time deployment is expected. That's why they've built their delivery server to give you comprehensive pipeline modeling, easily configured dependencies for fast feedback, and on-demand deployment with parallel and sequential execution. Of course, if you've worked in development, you know that it's not just about what a tool does, but what it doesn't do. Specifically, GoCD avoids spurious builds by giving you fan-in, fan-out dependency management so you're never wasting your time with an unneeded build. Their value stream map lets you track a change from commit to deploy at a glance. And GoCD's real power is in the visibility that it provides you over your end-to-end workflow. So you get complete control of and visibility into all your deployments across the organization. They also offer complete customization for all your software's individual needs. GoCD will perform tests written in most languages and frameworks. And their test reporting is so thorough that it won't just tell you that your build failed the test. It will tell you exactly which change set and on which platform a test started breaking. You can compare content across any two arbitrary builds, making it invaluable when troubleshooting a broken pipeline. It's also fantastically flexible. A tool needs to be able to adapt to the way that you work, to the way that your development schedule is. And GoCD supports audible deployment. It supports the delegation of configuration of pipelines to users without full-blown admin privileges. And it has extension points so that you connect any of a number of ready plugins or plugins that you write yourself. The TLDR is say goodbye to deployment panic and hello to consistent, predictable deliveries. Here's what we want you to do. We want you to stop working harder than you need to. GoCD is an open source program that you can download and use for free. Discover the power of their pipelines at gocd.io/twit. That's gocd.io/twit. Commercial support and enterprise add-ons, including disaster recovery, are also available. And we thank GoCD for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Let me take just a second before we get to our guest to say that we also greatly appreciate all of the people who are here as we're recording this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech, being part of our chat room. You know, we've had a great and very active chat room. We love all of our podcast listeners. We think you are just the bee's knees. But if you get a chance, you ought to come when we're doing this live, be part of this chat room. It is truly outstanding. We'd love to have your voice there. Now, it's time to talk to our guest, and our guest is someone who's going to talk to us about real-time analytics. You know, modern enterprises generate data faster than they generate just about anything else, whether we're talking about products or cash. Data is number one. Our guest today is Matt Cawthorn, who is VP of Sales Engineering at ExtraHop. I could sit here and read you a bunch of stuff about ExtraHop, but rather than doing that, we've got a video that I think is going to explain it better than I could. So, Kara, if you could roll that video, we'll learn some more about ExtraHop.
The modern data center is hyper-dynamic, with massive growth and complexity, and hundreds of interdependent systems that interact in haphazard ways. So, when there's a problem, how do you identify the cause? The answer is on the wire, in all the data already in motion in your infrastructure. Other tools record data for experts to analyze after the fact. But with the modern data center, you need to know what's happening in real time and in a way that's scalable. The ExtraHop platform requires no agents and analyzes traffic continuously, giving you real-time, comprehensive insight into all communications between all your systems. It takes raw, unstructured packets and transforms them into structured wire data, correlated across tiers so you can see what's really happening and act on the insights quickly. Wire data gives you the ultimate source of truth in your enterprise. The ExtraHop platform can show you when latency is the fault of the infrastructure and when applications are behaving badly. It can detect threats and give you the context to answer what, where, when, and who for any situation. It can show you how application and infrastructure performance impact user experience. It can also give you detailed views of every transaction between applications, databases, storage, and the network, so you know which tiers are using resources efficiently and which need help. To make sense of today's modern data center, you need an objective, outside-looking-in view, continuously, in real time, with context. That's wire data. That's the ExtraHop platform.
You caught me typing a message to a listener, but ExtraHop and what it does. I want to introduce now Matt Cawthorn. Matt, welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Now, we saw that video and it explained a lot, but you know, it's easy to wrap stuff in a very fuzzy set of descriptions and words. And I want to cut through some of that fuzz a little bit for our listeners. So can you tell us what specifically is ExtraHop doing?
Okay. So I'll start with to understand what we do and what we're doing. It's valuable to understand our charter and what we set out to do, what we try to accomplish on behalf of our customers. And at the end of the day, wire data analytics, as the video said, is our thing. And what that really enables, it nets out to quite a simple concept, which is informing decisions with data. And so I'll tell you a quick story. We do the trade show circuit, and I think it was an Interop or something like that. Last year, we had an infotainer there. And it sounds like a cheesy name, but the guy was awesome. He drew these big crowds and he interacted with them. And one of the things that he did is he said, how many of you, by show of hands, believe that IT operations, your operations, need to be more data-driven in general? And almost to a person, they raised their hands, crowd after crowd, session after session. And we exist to inform decisions with data, in particular for in the domain of IT operations. That's the NOC, the SOC, directors, the CIO. Because if you think about, to your point, the volume of data that's in flight right now in your environment, and if you're able to tap into that data and surface analytics proactively, preemptively, in real time, how would that affect IT operations? How would that affect the decisions that you have to make day in and day out? Would they make them better? If the answer is yes, then that's what we do. Like that's, you probably need to look into ExtraHop, frankly.
All right. Well, we've got that, and that's a great beginning. But you have to know, I mean, given what your job is, that you're not nearly the only company out there that likes to talk about analytics, and especially analytics for the IT operations crew. So with a lot of different analytics packages out there, what is ExtraHop doing that's different? What makes ExtraHop stand out from all of the other analytics packages out there?
Sure. So if you look at the landscape of operational analytics today, you're going to see it partitioned along the sources of the data. There's agent-based data, and we saw an ad earlier for application developers. They can and should be instrumenting their code to understand what the runtime looks like. There's logs, and the dominant source of data today, or at least historically, up to the last few years, has been log files, and those are valuable too. That's machine data that's sourced from the systems themselves. We specialize in wire data. We believe that the ultimate source of sort of observational truth, but wire data is the only source, if you think about it dispassionately, it's the only source of information in the network that's observed. It's not self-reported. We were talking earlier about some of the implications of, you know, security and things like that. And from a security perspective and from an analytics perspective, observing the behaviors of real production traffic as it presents on the wire gives you a purview that has never really been possible before. What we do differently, specifically to your question, is if you think about traditional packet capture technologies, let's say, there's lots of probes that are out there. They're all over the place, in fact, and they're 20 years old or so. And the technical problem that they set out to solve, starting with that charter 20 years ago, is, you know, you can imagine, does that work? Yeah. A pyramid, right? The top of the pyramid is this ingest point where you're trying to take raw packets from the wire, you write them to disk, and after you write them to disk, you sort of look backwards in time and try to pull out an individual stream or two of packets to hopefully derive an insight. It turns out that at modern scale, that process, that sort of historical process, buckles under its own weight. The workflows are very, very broken, especially when you get up north of 20 gigs per second, 40 gigs per second. What we do is we do analytics first. We run the analytics. So if you take that pyramid and you invert it, you know, we have the analytics first, and then we go down to transaction analysis and even the packets of origin if you need them. But generally speaking, we start with the analytics. We do that in flight in real time at scale, 40 gigs per second from a single box. I talked to a customer yesterday here in the South that was running with several different systems, about 220 gigs per second of real-time analytics from the wire in their environment. A single 40 gig appliance, for example, that's 400, the chat room can keep my math honest here. I believe that's about 432 terabytes of raw packet data per day. And so that problem of writing those packets to disk and getting some sort of look back becomes disproportionately difficult to solve if you don't do the analytics first in flight. So the short, that's a very long answer to a question, but the short answer is we do the analytics first. We run across millions of concurrent connections at scale. We process the traffic in memory, in flight, in real time. We replay all of the conversations that happen, and then we surface the actual metrics themselves as opposed to the raw data that surfaced it, if that makes sense. It's a very novel approach. It's a very unique approach. Even though we're out of band, we act like a stateful device.
That does make sense, and it brings up a lot of additional questions. I want to bring Brian, my co-host, in, because Brian spends a lot more time actually deploying network gear and servers than I do, and we've been in a back channel chat over here, and I know that Brian has some questions about just how you make all this happen with an extra hot box.
Yeah. So, for instance, we tend to like using our fictitious 10,000 seat enterprise. If I'm an IT director and I'm getting ready to go and drop in an extra hot box, so I want additional visibility, what kinds of pre-planning am I going to need to do? We all know that, you know, spans ports are great, but spans ports can get oversubscribed pretty easily. So I figure I'll probably want to do some taps and things like that. Maybe I've, you know, using some products from one of our previous guests, Gigamon, so that I can funnel key segments to devices like an extra hop. So if I have some taps in line already, what else do I need to consider for using an extra hop?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Generally speaking, if you have taps, and it's funny that you mentioned your prior guest, that's a partner of ours. We work with them very, very frequently. You know, what I would say is, because of our scalability characteristics, which are quite strong, frankly, we're able to consume many, many different network segments across tiers in the environment. So send us the VLANs that you care about. And if you have on the smaller side of the enterprise, in many cases, span ports work fine. You send us the VLANs of question. The subscription concern is a valid one that you raise. That's absolutely something to think about. If you have taps, we love taps. They work great. Generally speaking, from a high level, we deploy like a legacy or traditional packet sniffer would deploy, except our approach is very, very different. Our treatment of that data is very, very different. So generally speaking, we deploy near the servers. There's a very strong branch office and cloud use case as well, which we can potentially get into. But generally speaking, we deploy near the servers in the data center adjacent to them, and we see the consumers of those applications and those services that are being exposed. And so we like to do data analytics, and so we're fairly greedy. You send us the VLANs in the segments that you care about of the most critical components of the application delivery ecosystem, and we start to reassemble those streams on the fly in real time.
So, for instance, I'm at a university. We've got lots of goofy things happening on our network. So you're saying I could actually just go and say, drop a VLAN trunk from the different subnets and segments within my organization into an extra hop, and you guys can then peel it apart and start sorting through it. So this is not just a layer 2, layer 3, layer 4 device. It sounds like you're going all the way from layer 2 to layer 7. Is that true?
We are. So that's a really good – thank you for the question, because it bears some clarification. So given your scenario of the university, so what we'll do is once the packets hit us, we start to replay those packets and reassemble those streams of data on the fly in real time. And so generally speaking, if you're ready to send us data, you can deploy us, you rack us, stack us, give us a management IP, and give us the data. By the time you get back to your console, you start to see interesting things surfacing in the environment. And that's the full stream reassembly, the wired data analytics. That is the immediate sort of impact of it. And it runs sort of forevermore on men. And you're right. We reassemble the entire OSI stack from L2 up to L7, going into even replicating the TCP state of each endpoint. And the reason why we do that is because state really matters. For example, we're very fluent with databases and with Citrix and many, many different LDAP, lots of protocols. So let's take a database, for example. Let's say you have a campus scenario and there's a central database that is being accessed for, say, registrations or something like that. We're able to disambiguate the transport layer, the network that's delivering the actual transactions from the transactions themselves, and answer some very interesting questions. For example, how well is the database using the asset of the network, if you think of it as just this raw asset available to the enterprise? And likewise, how well is the network delivering those database transactions? And if it's not doing so well, which transactions are being affected, like down to the client server and the actual transaction itself? And what was the state of the network at the time that transaction occurred? And so, yes, to answer your question, we go all the way. We reassemble the entire application delivery chain of each endpoint, L2 to L7 of the OSI model. We're very protocol fluent, and we know what layer 7 transaction boundaries look like, and we know what the state of the network is when it delivered the transactions, even though we're out of band. It's a very novel approach.
Oh, that's super cool. Well, let's take this, you know, what if just a shade further. The world is going hybrid. You know, how is there some sort of way for me to extend this capability into my hybrid cloud? I might have some on-prem, I might have some in the cloud. You know, what other planning things do I need to know?
Yeah, so I'm really exercising a lot of restraint, because that's a particular, you were talking about rants earlier. I could go on a good rant here on cloud initiatives. We accommodate that. We're very deliberate about accommodating cloud, whether it's AWS or Azure, on-prem, hybrid models, because that's where the world is headed. And we're very, very sort of eyes open about that. And we need to be able to accommodate it. And here's why specifically. If you consider many of the megatrends, I'm not going to say all, but many of the megatrends in enterprise IT, especially in the application delivery and networking, you've got SDN, you've got cloud, you've got virtual infrastructures. All of these things are sort of workflow centric, and they enable agility that was never possible before. But they also, all of them, not some of them, but all of them, abstract you further away from having your finger on the pulse of the environment and really understanding the characteristics of your application delivery ecosystem. That's the server assets, the network, physical, virtual. We don't discriminate. So yes, the answer to your question is if it's VMware, fine. If it's AWS, we can accommodate deployments there too. Azure, fine. If it's a hybrid, we can mash all of those together and give you an interesting, for example, comparative view to answer questions like, well, I have an application running in physical hardware on-prem, and we're going to go to, say, AWS. Is it going to perform better, yes or no? And when the migration occurs, have you made a net gain or have you made a net loss? And answering questions like that, especially from a comparative sort of side-by-side view of the world, here it is in physical world, here's the same app in virtual world, these are the dependencies of that thing and the constraints of the transactions. Like, this is where you're bottlenecking, and maybe no, AWS will not help you. You need to fix the constraint first and only then go to the cloud. All of those are decision trees that we can help inform.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about the what you can do with those decision trees and the results, because one of the things that businesses are asking of IT more and more is that they not just be a keeping the lights on kind of service, but something that actually adds value to the business. Is this kind of analysis something that is likely to enable an IT group to actually add value to the business processes, or does it just make it that much easier to keep those lights on?
So that's a super, super good question. I came from IT ops. I've got the gray hair to show for it. And I try hard to remember, and this was, 14 or so years back, and I've been working in a couple of places, but the reason why I landed here is because I try hard and I really do remember well how difficult the charter is for IT operations as a discipline. And I don't care if it's the NOC level one, level two, the SOC, whatever, it's just application delivery and service delivery. And one of the things that was very apparent to me, especially after coming here 6 years ago now, is that we made very low quality decisions. And it wasn't because we were bad. It wasn't because we weren't good at our jobs or we weren't technical. It was because we weren't informing those decisions with data. And so that's sort of step one. And what my answer to your question directly is more of it's an evolution that we see. On, say, the left side of the spectrum, it might be right on the camera, I'm not sure. Over here, we see typically troubleshooting and triage, keeping the lights on, to your point, to answer your question. That's usually a leading use case. And what happens very, very quickly after that sort of low friction access to all this data is starting to bear fruit, we help solve a lot of problems. We help up-level the understanding of the environment at large. And then it turns into lots of information security and sort of its threat intelligence, its threat prevention, its remediation. It's all sorts of things, which to us is another variation of an analytical problem, frankly. A lot of the information security domain is really an analytics problem, and whether or not the industry at large has arrived there, I believe that to be true. And then on the farther end of the spectrum, we've seen certain organizations use us for full-blown business intelligence, even that feed workflows that go into Hadoop for some very, very advanced analytics. I'll give you one brief example of adding value. There was a discussion I had just yesterday about a new infrastructure rollout. And one of the things that they were asking is, well, how do we prioritize this? And when we make our server spend, which was very non-trivial, by the way, and we deploy it out to branches, how do we know which ones go first? And how should we prioritize that? Now, the business itself probably has some concept of that prioritization, but what we're able to do is help them sort of interleave that business preference from the pure P&L carrying business side with some empirical evidence of the performance characteristics of all the entirety of their branch deployment. So they were leveled up that decision completely and enriched it and changed their priorities, as it turns out, based on the wire data analytics of our platform, which is very value add. And it wasn't break fix at all. This is about making a smart business decision that gets things done more quickly, that's more agile and helps sort of them accomplish their goals and keep that project in flight.
Well, we're coming down towards the end of our time, but you mentioned a phrase in your last answer, and I'd like to poke at that phrase just a little bit. You talked about data friction. What precisely is data friction? You know, we're starting to hear that term used more and more often, and I would love to get a really good definition so we can understand the conversation.
Yeah, it's quite simple, and it goes sort of hand in hand with this idea of data gravity, which is, and you guys led earlier with this, is that as a source of raw data, enterprise IT is among the very best on the planet, really. It's just amazing. So, but what happens is the raw data itself, it has this sort of weight. It's very heavyweight, and it's difficult. It's not particularly portable. In other words, there's a lot of friction as it relates to getting at that data and giving it flight in the organization, being able to put that data to use. And so high friction or low friction data, we really, really work hard to be as low friction as possible. And what that means is you have these raw packets on the wire, 432 terabytes, for example, in a single day from a single box. How do you make that experience so the users can gain insight with a minimum of clicks? To sort of think of friction as an expression of clicks. How long does it take me to get to an insight? Does it take minutes or does it take hours? In the traditional approach, especially at scale, many of those workflows were defined by hours of time, of wall clock time. And that's because it was a very high friction operation. And we strive really, really hard to maximize the amount of data and minimize the sort of amount of pre-processed insights and minimize the amount of friction. Did that make sense?
You know, Matt, it absolutely did, as have the rest of your answers. So we very much appreciate that. And I'll tell you, the biggest problem I have right now is that our time with you has absolutely flown by. So we've come to the point in the interview where I get to ask you if there's anything you want the quiet audience to know. This is your chance to tell your story and get out anything you'd like to speak directly to the audience.
Sure. I would thank you. So first of all, at ExtraHop, we try hard to understand what it's like to run an IT operations environment at any scale. And as part of that, we try to align our offerings, and everything that we've added from a product functionality and a roadmap perspective has built on that thing before it. And of particular interest to the audience, I would say, is our machine learning world. We talked about low friction before. What I want to call attention to now is that if you think about our processing in the environment, in your environment, we're able to get that information and pre-process it, anonymize it. So it's sort of anonymized and specific to you, and then apply a set of machine learning algorithms to help give you this extra layer of insight that, you know, is kind of unprecedented, frankly. And so we're trying to imagine we could offer you a full-time employee with a PhD data scientist that could process a petabyte of data every day across all of these protocols, and they never were off the clock. 24/7, 365. That's what our machine learning service is. It's called Addy. And so it's a huge add in our portfolio. It's just released, and it's a very, very big deal that we're excited about. So if you could leave with one idea, it's wire data analytics and machine learning. It can kind of change the game for IT operations.
Well, Matt, before we let you go, is there a way that our listeners can keep up with you, a blog, social media? How can they follow you out there in the world of social media?
Yeah, so you can find me it's at MKoth, first initial, first four of my last name, MKoth on Twitter. And you can find me blogging on extrahop.com, absolutely. And LinkedIn is always there, too.
Well, we very much appreciate that. Our thanks to Matt Cawthorn, Vice President of Sales Engineering at ExtraHop. Well, that brings
Thank you.
Us.
It's great to be here.
That brings us to the end of another hour, and it's an hour that you have wasted with the best darn enterprise audio video podcast in the internet. And I couldn't do it, especially today, without my partner in crime, Brian Chi, out at the University of Hawaii. Brian, what are you going to be doing in the next week out there in paradise? I assume you're not going to be just sitting around sipping on a Mai Tai with Gromit.
No. Not for the foreseeable future. I get to go and do my continuing saga of aggregating smart meter data across the entire University of Hawaii system so we can build an energy model and figure out where it's most appropriate to integrate sustainable energy sources into the University of Hawaii grid. Now, I'm going to go and propose something to Matt. I've been tinkering with this idea about one of these fine days, maybe at a light reading conference someday. A lot of security really revolves around visibility and being able to spot things happening. Spot, you know, the trend is your friend. I am thinking that maybe someday we go and try and put together a panel of data experts like yourself and do a panel discussion on what the modern enterprise network really should look like to provide not only for a sustainable network, but also a secure network. What do you think?
Oh, sign me up. That sounds fantastic. Name the place and the time.
Yeah, I happen to know a gentleman that we've been tinkering with ideas for a conference, and that sounds like a really awesome panel discussion.
It sure does. No, that's a great idea.
you know, I was busy writing stuff down as you were talking about that. I like this one a lot. And I might just know a way to make something like that happen. We'll see what the future can bring for all of us.
Well, I'll tell you, thank you very much to the Twiat Riot. And see y'all next week.
Absolutely. For Matt Cawthorn, for Brian, and for me, thank you for being here. Before we go, our TD for this particular episode of Far Flung Folk has been Kara back at Twit Central. Kara, are you back there? Can you come out of the shadows
I'm
and
here.
Say hello? If you look
my
deep,
lights. Yeah.
Hey, there we go. Well, when you're not hiding out in the shadows, what have you got going on? Anything that everyone should know about?
Well, besides TDing, I help produce the new Screensavers, which is every Saturday at 3 p.m. Pacific. So y'all can come back tomorrow and watch that. And I do engineering behind the scenes.
And great engineering it is. We very much appreciate it. Anyhow. Well, as I said, for all of us here, thank you so much for being with us. Welcome back to the next episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Don't forget to be back here next week.